Okay, so the TAs are still grading, and I'm sure it's going fine. I heard this morning that lab grades, the column of lab grades, disappeared from Blackboard. We're asking TAs uploaded grades and directing over those and stuff, so we'll have to straighten that out. Eventually we'll get there. But if you look and find some odd things missing, save it and look again in a few days, and hopefully we'll have everything all squared away. Okay, I don't have a lot to say about the exam right now, except that we hope to have the target to hand it back to you is Thursday, and I'll have a lot to say then regardless. But do you have any issues? Well, I'm sure some of you have issues. I was really just referring to physics 114 things. Okay, so at the end of class last time, we were building on the concept of electric potential or energy considerations in electromagnetism, and I used Gauss's law to begin looking at a very specific geometry that we'll find to be very useful. And this geometry is at a physically unrealistic infinite plane, but of course if you're very close to that plane, any plane looks infinite if you're close enough. So it's not as unphysical as it might initially seem. And so if we have this infinite plane, and one of the reasons you choose it to be infinite is so you can make symmetry arguments, and one of those symmetry arguments is I can choose any point on this plane, and I can look at any piece of charge and look at what the field is doing, and there will be some mirror piece on the other side which will also have a field going the other way so that the transverse components will always cancel out. So when you look at this, you go, okay, the field has to be uniformly normal to this plane and will be going away on each side. And so to get a sense of, or to figure out what the field is, we can make a Gaussian surface. You can think of it as looking like this. You can think of it as a pipe, where the round part of the pipe bisects, or is bisected by this plane. So from the side, it looks a little bit like this. And then just use Gauss's law, so the integral of E dot dA is if you think about it, if the field is always going away from the plane normal, you'll only have a contribution to this integral for this surface and that surface. And in both cases, the field will be going out. So it'll be a net positive contribution to the flux. And so you will have 2 times the area of that piece, whatever it is, times the magnitude of the field. So that's what you have here. On the other side, you'll have the charge enclosed in this pipe. The charge resides on this plane, and that plane is a distribution of charge, which is charge per meter squared, a sigma. And so that sigma, if we constrain it to be uniform in this problem, times A will be the amount of charge that's enclosed in that pipe. So you have sigma A over epsilon naught. So solving for E, you get sigma over 2 epsilon naught for this infinite plane. And that's if you're going to carry around something in electromagnetism to remember, that one's a pretty good one to remember. The geometry we'll typically see, though, is one where we put that infinite plane, the one where we just determined the field, this one with the red charge, up next to another one which is parallel to it but has the opposite charge distribution, so a minus sigma. And if you look at this geometry, remember the electric field is a vector field, so regardless of what's going on, you look at the field at any given point as a vector superposition of the field from all the various parts. So if we do that here, and you look in this region, because this is minus, the field is now going in toward that plane. In this region, the field doesn't care where you are in terms of to the side of the plane. They can be very, very far away, and you still have a field of the same strength, which may sound very weird, but remember you have this infinite plane, so you get some weird things when you have infinite things. So our calculation of the field has no dependence on where you are. So if we look in this entire region here to the left of both of the planes, this one, the positive one, has a field going away from it. The negative one has a field going toward it. Because sigmas are the same, they have exactly the same magnitude, opposite in direction, so they cancel over here. And similarly, they cancel over here. So you end up with no field here, no field here, and in this region, they add together. So you have 2 times sigma over 2 epsilon naught, or just sigma over 2 epsilon naught between these two plates. So we end up with a geometry which looks like this, where we have charge separated, and you have a uniform field in the region between the plates, and it's a sigma over epsilon naught. And that is a very useful thing to know. We use it in a number of instances. We call it a parallel plate geometry, and sometimes you may hear it referred to as parallel plate capacitors, and we'll come to that toward the end of this class, probably, what I mean by capacitor. But this is not a crazy geometry. It's very useful for us in a sense because the field is a very uniform and easy to understand configuration. And this is actually very easy to make. You take 2 plates, you put them beside each other, you take a battery and you connect it to the 2 plates, and you have positive charge on one and negative charge on the other. And you go, but that's not infinite. I say, well, if they're fairly close together and they're reasonably big plates and you're an ant in the middle, it looks infinite. So it's not a bad approximation. Okay? So, yes?
In the last slide, I didn't get y multiplied by 2.
So the question was, why did I multiply by 2 here? And the reason is, this is the integral over the entire Gaussian surface of the flux, and there's no contribution from the round part, but if I look at this piece, I have the flux going through this way, and if I look at this piece, I have the flux going through that way. So So the electric, and if I just set it up so that these are each the same distance away, it turns out it won't matter in this problem, but for simplicity I do it for symmetry. Then I have the electric field times that area plus the electric field times that area would be the total sum of the flux. So that's where you get the factor of 2. Okay? Anything else? Okay, so as I say, it's sort of a useful geometry that we use for a number of things, and one of the things that I wanted to do with it is to talk a little bit about a new unit that we'll see a lot, and also give us a mechanism whereby we can accelerate particles for different things. And so one thing you can imagine is taking 2 plates and hooking them up between the poles of a 1-volt battery. So the whole idea of a 1-volt battery is it's a device that creates a potential difference between 2 poles of the battery, such that if I were to move charge from one point to the other, it would take 1 joule per coulomb. It would take 1 volt. There's a 1 volt potential difference, and so that represents the joules per coulomb it takes to move charge from one point to another. But another way to think about it is if I were to take a charge, and for simplicity, let's just take a charge which has a charge of 1 electron's worth of charge, 1d, and I put it infinitesimally close to that negative plate, it's going to be repelled from the negative plate, and it's going to go toward the positive plate. And if we ask how much energy does it gain as it moves through that entire region, it's going to gain an energy which is equal to its charge, E, times that potential difference. Okay, so that will be a kinetic energy that it gains. So the work that is done on this charge as it goes from this point to that point by the plates here is going to be Q times that potential difference. And that'll be its kinetic energy. Q is, in Coulombs, it's this ridiculous number, 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19. And so if we ask what is the kinetic energy in standard MKS units, it's going to be, for a 1 volt difference, is 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19 joules. So in this world where if it's macroscopic and we're dealing with cables and transformers and, you know, plugging things into the walls, then these MKS units that we're using are not super crazy. But in a world where you're dealing with chemical type things, so moving around electrons and talking about atoms and making particle beams and things like that, part of the issue is I take a simple 1-volt battery and ask what's the kinetic energy I get if I accelerate a little particle, and I get this ridiculous number, okay? The number's perfectly good, but nobody really likes to carry around exponents. It's not that convenient. So just to make life a little simpler to us, and probably it adds a little job security to physicists around the world because it makes it a little opaque to everybody else, we define a new system of unit, which is just called the electron volt. And that's just simply how much energy something gets when you take an electron and you let it accelerate through a potential difference of so many volts. Okay, it's that simple. So one electron volt is equal to this kinetic energy, or 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19 joules. If I have a proton and I do the same game with it and I accelerate it through a potential difference of 30 volts, that proton has a kinetic energy of 30 eV. Because it has an electric charge, opposite sign, but it's the same magnitude charge as the electron. Okay? Now, because job security is so important, we do like to slip things in on you just a little bit. So hopefully we'll have a little time at the end of this term that we'll talk a bit about the special theory of relativity. I'm going to just make use of one of the pieces that comes out of that. One of those pieces is that within that theory, you can see that mass, rest mass, is really just a different kind of energy. And there's a relationship between rest mass and energy, which is a very famous equation that you see all over the place, that just says E equals mc squared. So this is a legit equation, and hopefully we'll have time to actually see where it comes from. But a way to think about it is mass is just a different form of energy. If I have enough energy to equal the mass of a particle and an antiparticle, that energy will actually take that form, and it will just pop into an antiparticle-particle pair. So it's not really that different from other types of energy that you're used to. It's just normally the energies we're talking about are so large that it's not something you usually have to worry about. But if you look at this, what we've just talked about was a kinetic energy unit, an electron volt. And we can talk about a mass, which is an energy unit divided by c squared. So it turns out that you will usually see physicists and often chemists will refer to masses of particles in very odd units. They don't use kilograms. They'll usually talk about some number of electron volts divided by c squared. So the mass of an electron, for example, in these units is 0.511 million electron volts per c squared, so MeV over c squared. Okay, so if you really get that, good. Then we go you one worse by just very often we use units where C is equal to 1 and we just refer it to it as MeV. Okay, so it can be really confusing if you care enough to try to figure out what those units really are. There's a lot of sort of hidden stuff there. I'll try to be fairly explicit about this. We will use these units some. Sometimes we'll use kilograms. Sometimes you may have to go back and forth, but you can, it's doable. But I'll try to be pretty transparent with that and just stop and ask questions if you want. Partly why I'm telling you this is because I'm hoping that most of you read interesting stuff out there. And if you read very much in terms of chemistry at large energy scales or particle physics or cosmology or things like that, you'll find that they're talking about masses in terms of million or GeV or TeV and stuff like that. So these are the energies that they're talking about. So to just get a sense of it, I believe the Large Hadron Collider is about to turn on again, which is the highest energy accelerator that we've built in the world. The basic principle of acceleration is not so different from what we just talked about, in that the only way you accelerate these particles is by accelerating them through a potential difference. So this accelerator works in the same way. To get a scale of these kinds of things, though, remember that I mentioned early on, start of the class, that there was a pretty good number to keep it in. And that is that the ionization energy for the ground state of hydrogen is 13.6 electron volts. Okay, so we use that unit there. That's a measure of changes in energy that you get when you move electrons around in atoms. That's chemistry. That sets the energy scale for everything we're doing in chemistry. You might have things that have more energy than that, but you're not going to have things that are really much beyond an order of magnitude or more than that. Thousands of electron volts, the kind of thing that you might get. If I take the mass of a single electron and I convert it to these units, it's 500,000 electron volts per c squared. So even the mass of a single electron is large on the scale of that. If we talk about accelerating particles, we found that we can accelerate through a 1 volt potential difference and get 1 eV. That would be with a standard battery. The Large Hadron Collider has an energy which is, they're accelerating protons. At each beam of protons, this round will have something on the order of 7 TeV. So that's 7,000,000,000,000,000 electron volts. If I didn't drop a factor of 1,000 in there, it's huge, okay? Single nuclear reactions, as we'll find, the typical changes in energy, if you were to, say, ionize a nucleus by pulling a nucleon out of a nucleus, the changes in energy you typically see are millions of electron volts. So that's why chemical bombs go boom and nuclear bombs go kablooey. It's that difference. If you take a bunch of these things and you rearrange them, that's the level of difference you have in the energy plates. I wouldn't want to live anywhere near the Large Hadron Collider with those energies, except for the fact that we're talking about single particle reactions. So it's not like you have a mole of these things with that energy going all at once. If you did that, Switzerland would be vaporized. So we're not doing that. Okay, so that's the electron volt. All right. Put at least one of you to sleep already today, so we're gonna do a demo. Okay. Here's what we have in front of us. We have sort of a cool device. It's called a Van de Graaff generator. It has a belt of material here. Think of it as a sort of a big rubber band. And it has some material down there and some brushes up here that are connected to a conductor. So what happens is this material on this band rotates down, rubs against something else. You have a difference in electronegativity, so charge is deposited on the band. The band then comes up here where conducting brushes basically remove the charge or some of it and deposit it on this thing. So this little generator is a way of actually creating a fairly large potential on this thing. This now is actually connected across this. So this is all one conductor, if you wish. And nothing exciting, hopefully, is going to happen with that one. But the way to think about that is we have several conducting balls here. Let me try to get the geometry right. Okay, so what I'm trying to do is to make these two be along one line, these two be along one line, so that they are the equidistance apart. And then I'm going to connect these two using a conducting wire, and these two using a conducting wire, and then I'm going to put these across a big potential difference, which is this mirror device that I just described. If all of that didn't register, just think of it as a big battery. Okay? And that big battery I'm connecting across these conductors. All right, so then the question that I have for you is, what we're planning to do is I'm going to keep shoving charge on this. That is, this potential difference is going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And the way you do that is you put more and more charge on it. So I'm going to be putting more charge and more charge and more charge on these things until eventually the electric field in this region is going to be so great that it's going to rip molecules in the air apart in their charges, and you're going to get a spark. That's what you mean when you talk about a spark. So what happens is you rip the charges apart and they accelerate, just like we were talking about, but now they accelerate with enough kinetic energy that they'll knock other electrons off of other atoms and things. And as those electrons sort of cascade back in and recombine, they emit light. And that light is part of what you see as a spark. And it makes sound and all sorts of fun stuff like that. So, you know, lightning's a big one. This is a small one. So, okay. So that's the deal. And I have a question for you. And we're going to take a big vote on this. Okay. I want to know which of the following three things is going to happen. Is the spark going to jump between the big balls? Is the spark going to jump between the little balls? Or is it basically going to jump between both simultaneously? So you got to commit, okay? You got to be wishy-washy, or you got to be a big ball person or a little ball person. So think about that for a minute. You are more than welcome to sketch on a piece of paper and ponder this for a moment. Thank you. Okay. You ready to commit? Just so you're not too biased by other people, if you would close your eyes. All of you who think that the spark will first jump between the big balls, raise your hand. All between the smaller balls, raise your hand. All between both at the same time. Okay, so we had a scattering of hands saying big ball. We had probably 20% of the class that said the small balls, and then it looked to be 20% must be low. Maybe 40%. We had maybe 30 or 20% who said between both at the same time. And my guess is there was a good 30 or 40% that just didn't commit. have commitment issues. All right. So let's see what happens. Okay. First of all, so to make sure that they are about the same distance apart, they are more or less. Maybe not now. Definitely not now. Alright, I'm not doing so well here. What makes you think that that could be the case?
Because the centers of the spheres are closer, so it's just the source of the charge is closer.
There is a relation, but I don't think I would say it that way.
Is it because the charges are concentrated on the two smaller things? So
she's saying, if you can't hear her, is it because the charges are concentrated on the smaller things? Is that true? What causes the spark to happen? If it happens preferentially in one place, what is that saying about that space? Not conducting. But well, it is conducting momentarily when you rip it apart. That's what the spark is. Yeah.
It's a smaller distance.
Smaller distance, but it's not. We set it up so that it's not. The one thing you know is that there's an electric field there that has to be larger. That's why you're going to rip apart things there instead of somewhere else. So then the question is, why is the electric field in it? The space here larger than it is here. Okay. What do you think?
Because the amount of charge each ball goes according to the radius, and the smaller ball has a much smaller volume relative to how the radius is small. And so it's more concentrated.
All right, you're there. You're beating all around it. You just need to write it down carefully. But let's do that. No, I mean, I think he's got it. So we're getting there. All right. So the first thing he says is that the charge goes as the radius, right? And how do you know that? We did something with that earlier. You know that. Because the one thing that you can hang your hat on here, since this is all in one conductor, is that whatever else happens, this piece is all at the same potential, and that piece is all at the same potential. Okay? So what that means is that this ball and that ball, they're at the same potential. They have very different areas and radii, but what I know is that they're at the same potential. So if I take a pile of charge, and that's what this thing is doing, it's just taking a pile of charge and putting it there, and a pile of charge the opposite sign and putting it there. So that's all it's doing. So how does it get distributed? We don't worry about the rest of this geometry, really. We just have these two balls, okay? And we know what happens if we take charge from infinity and we put it at a certain radius of something in the spherical geometry. The potential at that point is kq over r. So what that means is if I look at the big ball and the little ball, each of them, so let's just call this one has r1 and this one has r2. And they're connected by a conductor, but I deposit some big charge Q, which is going to be equal to Q1 plus Q2, where Q1 is the amount of charge that goes on ball 1, and Q2 is the amount of charge that goes on ball 2. What I know is that at the radius of these balls, they're at the same potential. So I know that K times Q1 over R1 is equal to K times Q2 over R2. And that's where he gets the statement that the charge goes as the radius, because if they're at the same potential, then Q1 is proportional to R1 and Q2 is proportional to R2. So that's the constraint we have. And now we can ask, if that's the constraint, that's how the charge is distributed, what does that mean for the electric field? And for a spherically geometric system, I know that the electric field on ball 1, for example, goes as K times Q1 over R1 squared, and the electric field at the surface for the small ball goes as K times Q2 over R2 squared. This is equal to K times Q1 over R1 times 1 over R1. This is equal to K Q2 over R2 times 1 over R2. And we've just said they're at the same potential, which means this chunk and that chunk are equal. So if I take the ratio, say E1 to E2, that's going to be equal to 1 over R1 over 1 over R2, which is R2 over R1. So the electric field goes as E1 goes as R2, which is smaller. E2 goes as R1, which is bigger. Or the electric field goes as 1 over the radius. So that means as the radius becomes smaller, the electric field gets bigger. So for the same amount of charge, if I were to take charge and distribute it on the surface, the electric field is largest where you have small radii of curvature, or where you have small balls. So the electric field is going to be greater at the edge of this small ball, and that will rip apart the molecules of air than here, And then once they rip apart, you get charge jumping, and that reduces the electric field everywhere, which is why you then get nothing over here. And you get the repeated jump because once you remove the charge, the spark stops because the field is reduced. You have an insulator again, and then the charge builds up until it's big enough to rip apart the air again. If I just plugged it into the wall, which I'm not going to do, but if I were, then you would have a constant spark until the lights went out.
Okay, that's pretty cool, right? Okay, so let's talk a little bit about what you're all experts on. Let's suppose I have a big mass here, and I have a little mass here. It could be a big mass, but think of it as a little mass. For simplicity, if you want, in your thinking, instead of these being generic masses of almost the same size, you could imagine this being Earth and this being a kid. Okay, so there are two masses. And now, the question I have is, let's say I have mass 1. Mass 1 starts out at position A. And then we move it to position B. How does the potential energy that is stored in the system change as I move the mass 2 from A to B? Mass 2 is a kid on a sliding board. And the kid starts at the top of the sliding board and slides to the bottom of the sliding board. How does the potential energy in the system change?
It decreases over nature.
Decreases, right, by amount mgh, right? Because the kid starts out not moving, slides, if there's no friction, at the bottom they're moving, they now have kinetic energy. What's happened is you've taken gravitational potential energy, which you can derive using gmm over r squared, and you probably did it, but we convert it into mgh for simplicity. If you're at the surface of the Earth, we say that the acceleration due to the Earth is just this small quantity g. I hope at some point you actually derive what g is. What g is just g mass of the Earth over the radius of the Earth squared. So it is just that chunk. We just encapsulate it and call it that little constant g to make all the calculations we do right at sea level simple. All right, but okay, so we have a conversion of gravitational potential energy into kinetic energy when that mass moves at that point. All right. Or another way to think about it is, if I have the mass and it magically appears at point A, there's a certain amount of gravitational potential energy stored in that system. If instead of at point A, it appears and is at point B, there's also going to be gravitational potential energy stored in the system, but there is less if it's here than it is if it's here. Another way to think about that is, what do you mean when you talk about potential energy? Well, you mean energy. What is energy? Energy is the capacity to do work. You can do work if something is moving, for example. So we accelerate something. So if I put a mass here at point A and let it go, and there's nothing else in the universe so that it just reacts to gravity, it will accelerate. And by the time it gets to point B, it actually will have kinetic energy as well as be at point B. So you'll have whatever gravitational potential energy you have here, plus this, which is converted into kinetic energy. Right? So you have to have more gravitational potential energy if you're here at A, because I can let it go and it can fall to B. If the mass is a book, if I have it up here, it has more potential energy, because if I let it go, It's going to hurt more if it lands on my toe than it will if I drop it from here. Okay, it can exert a bigger force times distance on my toe, if you will. And that's a way to sort of think about it. So that's the way gravity works.
And we have the exact same thing with electromagnetism. It's really not so different. Take dq over r squared instead of dmm over r squared. So you shouldn't be too surprised. So let's imagine that I have some plus q here, and it will have an electric field. And if we define the potential at infinity to be zero, I can say the potential at some point r, a radius r, away from this sphere, I'll call it V plus, is equal to K times Q over R. In fact, we just used that in this last example. Let's say that somewhere else in the universe, far enough away that it doesn't really affect this positive one at the moment, we have a minus Q. That will have the same thing going on, except the field is going in the opposite direction. And now, it will also have a potential, and its potential will go as minus Q, KQ over R. I'll call that V minus. So you can sort of think of these as being true.
I guess they are true. I don't have to have them very, very far away. I can even have them very close, so long as I say, what is the potential due to the positive charge? It's going to be KQ of R. What is the potential due to the negative charge? It's going to be minus KQ over R, wherever R is relative to, here you're talking about the R from that charge, there you're talking about the R from the other charge.
If I were to take, say, charge, so let's
make it a little simpler. Let's say that these two spheres each have the same radius of R, and the point that I'm talking about in each case is on the sphere itself. Okay? So I have a KQ over R is the potential right there, minus KQ over R is the potential right there due to that charge. And now I'd like to ask, what is the potential difference between these two points?
Delta V is equal to V plus minus V minus, which is going to be 2 times KQ over R. So here V plus is proportional to R, and this alpha I'm using as a constant, it just says it's proportional to it, if you've not ever seen that before. V minus is proportional to R, proportional to Q. V minus is proportional to Q, and note that this V plus minus V minus, this potential difference between the two, is also proportional to Q. All that changes is what is the constant of proportionality in each case. So you might say, Professor Manley, this is really fine and nice, but why do I give a crap? And the reason you give a crap is that in any system, we'll find that the potential is proportional to the charge on the system. And we define a constant of proportionality. And that constant of proportionality is given the symbol C, and we call it the capacitance. The capacitance is in units of Q over V, which is going to be in coulombs per volt. which is a symbol that we call the farad, which is a pretty strange sounding thing.
That is actually named after a guy called Faraday that we'll talk about later in class. Okay?
I would like to just point out, I think we've seen this before, C is capacitance, C is calorie, C is heat capacitance, different thing, C is the speed of light, which is also used today, C is charge. There are some instances where it is conventional to have large C's and other instances where it's conventional to have small C's. And if you're like me, you can't tell the difference anyway. And you're right. Clearly, you're going to have to know which C by context. Yes?
How would you justify the need for capacitance? Like, why we have it?
That's a really good question. Actually, and I'm not really sure I have a great answer for you right now. So they ask, why do we need this? And I think it will become clear that it's useful as I carry on. So let me try to answer your question right off. I think it'll become clearer as we go. For a given set of plates, for example, finite plates, real plates, okay? As I shove more and more charge on them, I will have a potential difference across them that is carefully related to the electric field that it takes to go from one point to the other, because that's what potential is work per unit charge to move from one point to the other. It turns out if I have a different set of plates with a different geometry, I'll get a different field for the same amount of charge. So this capacitance turns out to be something that describes the relationship between the charge you can put on the system and the potential difference you'll get across the system. And that varies depending on the geometry. So it will turn out, and will prove for at least one example, that the capacitance really depends only on geometry. But it's a very useful sort of quantity. Okay. So, we'll use it a lot, and hopefully it will become a bit clearer. I have to confess, when you ask me that question, I don't think I've found a good way to sort of jump in capacitance.
I mean, the way it's great for me to say that is a ratio of charge per potential.
Yeah, so that's what it's for. Given geometry, if I put a certain amount of charge on something, it tells me what the potential is. Or if I were to put pieces of that across a potential difference, in doing that, it would draw a certain amount of charge on. Depending on the geometry I choose, that relationship will be different. And that's what the capacitance tells you about.
So the capacitance is sort of it's one of our first steps into a bit of the real world, because it's easier to talk about if it's on that finite system, an actual geometric system. Okay, so in fact, I was going to say capacitance depends on the geometry only. We'll prove that in a few minutes. So let's see how we might use this a little bit. Let's imagine that we have a battery. We don't usually call them batteries. We usually call them EMFs. Batteries are too straightforward. There's a theme there if you haven't picked up on it. Electromagnetic, electromotive force which is also not a great name for it, because the force it's given, it is making a force in the sense it's got a force that's moving charge from one point to another. Think of it as a battery, but the point is you can have other things that will do it. This isn't a battery, for example. It's a different type of device that takes charge and moves some here and some there. So this would be generically an EMF. A battery would be an EMF. If I have a generator in a car or something, it's an EMF. A generator at the power plant is an EMF, and you see the voltage difference when you plug it into the wall. So there's lots of different ways to do this. Usually think of it as a battery, but just so you know, when you look at circuit diagrams, the battery isn't labeled B, it's labeled E. Not E as in electric field E, but E as in epsilon sort of E. That's how you usually see it. And that epsilon sort of E counts is there because it represents the EMF. You maybe never wanted to know that, but now you have to know it, so I'm going to tell you about it anyway. So let us imagine we have an EMF or a battery, and we hook conducting wires up to it, and we take these and we hook them across two plates. Okay.
Do you see that this is not the same as that? They're different. This is an EMF. This is a capacitor. Here, these represent parallel plates, which is the simplest way to envision a capacitor, is something with two parallel plates. If you think of it that way, it means you even know what the electric field is across those plates, because we've already calculated. Okay? And if I put a certain amount of charge, and I tell you the area, you know what sigma is, you can even calculate it. Okay? But that's the way to think of this. Now, in reality, I could make capacitors out of all sorts of strange shapes. And in reality, they are. So I could take one of these plates and curl it up like that, and take the other plate and curl it up like that, and then hook them to the wires, okay? And in fact, what we will find is something like that, is the capacitance for this would be much greater than the capacitance of actually just parallel plates. So this is a generic symbol that we put in a circuit diagram, and unless I tell you what kind of capacitor it is, it doesn't matter to you what it really is in reality. Unless I tell you this is a battery, it doesn't matter. It's just something that gives a potential difference. It's a source of charge. This is just a place to store charge. But it could be like that. It could be like standard parallel plates. If I'm expecting you to think of it as parallel plates because I want you to do some parallel plate calculation or something, then I'll have to say so. Okay? Otherwise, it's just a capacitor that has a certain capacitance. All right, so here we are. Is this our first circuit diagram?
It is, isn't it?
You want me to pause for selfies?
Big moment, right?
It's a big moment. Okay, your first circuit diagram.
Does my heart good. Okay. So all the EMF does is it maintains a potential difference between two points. And those two points are what we connect to with these conducting wires, and then we happen to hook them up to this capacitor. Okay. So that is the geometry we've got. And so for the moment, let's think of them as parallel plates, this capacitor. And let me blow it up a little bit bigger so that we have the conductor looking sort of finite. The plates I will draw exaggerated, or not exaggerated, looking small compared to the wire. But let us imagine that they look something like this. And let me think of this using Gauss's law. I'm going to draw a Gaussian surface. That looks like this. Okay, so we're going to make an approximation, which is I'm not going to worry about what's happening, right? The edge is cut. I have an office hour starting at 2. Okay, so I'm not going to worry about what happens at the edges here. Let's assume that the field goes straight across as if they are big infinite plates and we know all about them. And that is a good approximation so long as this dimension is really large compared to this dimension, which we'll just assume it is for a moment. And so let me also assume that these plates have surface area A, and I'll put a plus Q here and a minus Q here. And then if we use Gauss's law, then this top surface of the Gaussian surface, I've deliberately drawn inside the conducting plate. So the field is by definition zero. I'm going to assume that the field is going straight from the top plate to the minus plate, so it's normal to the plates. We've already established that that's true. It will be true everywhere except a little bit right here, and I'm just going to sort of ignore that for the moment. If I do, the field is going straight this way. The area of this is out that way, so E dot dA, the little edge, is going to be zero. If you don't like that, I'll just make the plate bigger, and it's more and more true, okay? So I can make the plate as big as I want and make that as good an approximation as you like. So this, then, is the piece where we have an electric field penetrating through the area, and so that just becomes the flux then through that entire Gaussian surface becomes E times A, and that's equal to Q enclosed over epsilon naught. The Q enclosed over epsilon naught is going to be equal to just Q plus Q, okay? So plus Q, or the Q enclosed, is equal to E times A times epsilon naught, is another way to think about it. At the same time, I've already defined capacitance, so Q is equal to C times V, or C is equal to Q over V. So the capacitance of the system is equal to Q, which is the electric field, times A times epsilon naught, divided by the potential difference. The potential difference between these two plates is E times that distance, right? What is the potential difference? It's the work per unit charge. So that would be work divided by charge. Field is equal to, let me slow it down a little bit. The work is force times distance, if you will, and the force is Q times E. So this whole thing turns out to be E times D. That would be the potential difference between the two. The E's cancel out, and you end up with epsilon naught A divided by D. And so, as I promised, this depends on the geometry alone. So I can vary the capacitance by changing the distance, changing the area, and so I will. Yes?
Is the Gaussian surface of the entire plate?
No, in this case, I chose the Gaussian surface so that one goes right in the midst of the plate. and the other goes between the two plates.
And why is the charge all just Q?
Because if I put these at a potential difference, the positive charge is going to reside on this surface, and the negative charge on that surface, because the negative charge over here is attracting the positive charge toward it, and vice versa. If I didn't have this plate here, that charge would distribute itself around the conductor. Okay, so with this simple geometry, we can derive what the capacitance is for parallel plates, and it's this epsilon naught A over B. This, again, is a useful thing to know. You'll have to do problems with it. It'll go on your formula sheet, and you can put it on your formula sheet if you will. That's a good thing to know. So we're going to do lots of interesting things with this particular model of a capacitor, but before we do too much with that, I want to think for a moment about the fact that, generally speaking, we're not going to have a world with just one capacitor, we're going to have multiple capacitors. And so we need to talk about how we deal with multiple capacitors if we have those in a problem. So, one type of thing we could imagine doing is to have an EMF, and I could, instead of drawing my little epsilon like I did a minute ago, I'll just put a V. And if you see that beside the EMF, it's really telling you that you have an EMF or a battery that has a potential difference of V across its two poles. All right, so it's the same thing. Sometimes it might be an epsilon, and the number that's beside it would be the potential difference. So you'll see lots of different notations just to make life simple. And we'll take this battery and I could then connect this battery across a capacitor, which I'll call C1. I could connect it across another one, which I'll call C2, and I could connect them across a whole slew of them, up to CN, if you will. And then the question is, if I put each of these capacitors at a certain potential, what I mean by that is each of them is connected across the same battery. This is all one wire, all one conductor. So this is all at one potential, this is all at one potential. So with this geometry, I'm putting each of the capacitors across the same potential loop. And I could then calculate the charge on each of these capacitors individually. But the other question I might ask is, suppose that I think of this as one capacitor. Then I know for that big capacitor, the total charge Q is equal to C, which is the capacitance of this combination of capacitors, times V. So what's in pink, you can think of, I have all this complicated thing, but then I take a shoebox and I put it all within that shoebox. And then I close the box, and now that's one big capacitor. So I'm going to look at it that way. So then the question is, what is C in terms of C1, C2, to CN. Okay,
So I have C1, I have a potential difference V across it, so that I know Q1 is equal to C1 times V, Q2 is equal to C2 times V, Q sub n is equal to C sub n times V, by definition. The total charge Q that goes inside this box has to be equal to the sum of the charges on each of these capacitors. So that's Q1 plus Q2 plus Q. Up to Qn. So Q is equal to Cv. Q1 is equal to C1 times V. Q2 is equal to C2 times V. And Qn is equal to Cn times V. The V's are the same everywhere, so they go out, so that I get C is equal to C1 plus C2 up to Cn. Or the total capacitance is just the algebraic sum of the individual capacitors. Okay? I guess I should rewrite that. So these capacitors are set up so that there are parallel paths to reach them if you think of the charge as flowing on a river or something. So we say that this system is where you have capacitors in parallel. Okay? So there's another geometry that we need to consider, and between the two of them, it takes care of all geometries, and that would be one where we have capacitors in series. So we have our potential difference here, and now we take it and we hook it across a system of capacitors that look like this. Now, this system would be known as capacitors in series. And again, I'd like to sort of put this inside a big shoebox, and I'll call the capacitance of this whole system big C. Okay? And if I think of it that way, then I know a certain amount of charge gets pulled off of this battery, and that's the amount of charge that sort of goes in one side of the shoebox and on the other side of the shoebox. So a total charge is equal to Q is equal to C times this potential difference. So Q is equal to Cv. And now you might ask, well, what's the charge on each of these stupid capacitors? So a way to think about that is the following. I have positive charge that comes on this pole and negative charge here. So that means the positive charge is here, and the magnitude of that charge is Q. The negative charge is here, and the magnitude of that, and it is minus Q. Okay, that's what I mean this thing is going to do. What is happening in here? Think of it this way. This is a conductor. If I put a plus Q here, it's going to induce a minus Q on this surface, leaving a positive Q here, which induces a minus Q on that surface, which leaves a plus Q on that surface, inducing the minus Q on that surface. Okay?
So in this type of system, if I put a plus Q here and a minus Q here, I have the same charge on each of the capacitors, okay? Because they basically will induce that charge on each of the successive surfaces.
So if you follow that, then that means Q1 is equal to, Q is equal to C1 times V. We'll say that Q1 is equal to C1 times... Oh, sorry, I'm looking at the wrong pass. Q over C is equal to V is equal to Q over V1. That would be... Let me say this the right way. If I'm a charge, I have to fight my way through each of these. And what I mean by that is you have to fight your way across the potential difference. If I think about this whole thing, I'm fighting my way across that big potential difference. But now I'm going through all of these successively. So this potential difference total is equal to the potential difference across each of these individually. So I have that V is equal to V1 plus V2 plus V sub n. V is equal to Q over C, and the Q's are the same everywhere because we just said that they were, and I hope that made sense. So Q is the same here, that's over C1, plus Q over C2, all the way to Q over C sub n, which means that 1 over C is equal to 1 over C1 plus 1 over C2 up to 1 over C sub n, or 1 over C is equal to the sum from I equal 1 to n of 1 over C sub I. So if the capacitors are in series, 1 over the big C is equal to the sum of 1 over the C for all the individual pieces. Okay? So it's sort of the reciprocal formula from 1 over the parallel. We will stop there.